Live from the Ken and Valerie Baker Studio at WHYY, this is Studio 2.
On Tuesday, September 23rd, welcome, 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 friends, to the show. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. Today, we are talking about something that's been in the headlines since yesterday afternoon, when President Donald Trump and HHS Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. called the press into a big room and made a lot of statements about a causal link between taking Tylenol during pregnancy and autism. Now, the existing body of research does not support the conclusion that the president laid out yesterday. So we're going to talk about that today on the show. We're also going to talk about what advice the experts have for pregnant women or folks who will become pregnant when it comes to taking painkillers. And we'll also look at where the state of autism research is today and where it could be heading after what we heard yesterday from the president and RFK Jr. We're asking you this hour, what questions do you have about President Trump linking Tylenol to autism? Give us a call, 888-477-9499. You can email studio2 at whyy.org. If you're on YouTube or Facebook, drop a comment in the chat.
Yeah, and when families hear a presidential warning, typically, there's some panic, but that's why we are bringing on the experts. Again, what questions do you have about Trump linking Tylenol to autism? 888-477-9499. The email is studio2 at whyy.org.
Trio of local news stories to start us off, Cherry. And you've got the first one. It's pretty interesting.
Yes. Former Vice President Kamala Harris is promoting her new book. It's called 107 Days, and it spills a lot of tea from her campaign, and there's some that spills into Pennsylvania and into Philadelphia.
Oh, no.
Yes. The Philadelphia Inquirer did a nice write-up on the local spillage, and the first story that stood out is...
It's like some sort of toxic chemical.
I know. Former President Biden apparently called the vice president ahead of her only debate against Donald Trump here in Philadelphia. She was expecting a pep talk from him. Instead, he told her that his brother has spoken to a, quote, a group of real power brokers in Philly who had planned not to support her. Apparently, their lack of support stemmed from Harris allegedly saying bad things about Biden. He told her, according to the book, he didn't believe it, so she shouldn't worry about it. All of this told right before she was supposed to debate President Donald Trump.
A little strange.
Yeah, little strange.
Strange timing.
Weird call. Second sip of tea is Harris tells the story of how she was on a September 11th campaign stop in Shanksville, Pennsylvania. She was pretty nervous about it because it was MAGA country, right? They stopped at a firehouse where a man took off his MAGA hat, handed it to then President Biden, who then put that hat on. A photo of Biden wearing that hat went viral. And of course, Harris was mortified that this all happened right in front of her. And she's thinking in her head, don't put it on, don't put it on. He puts it on. Snap, snap, snap. It goes viral. The final sip that I'll give you, because you should read this article by Rob Torno of the Philadelphia Inquirer. That final sip is about Josh Shapiro, our governor. And let's just say his interview for the VP slot rubbed Harris the wrong way. She said that he seemed to want to be co-president and peppered her with lots of questions, saying he wanted to be in the room for every major decision. Of course, you know, she ended up picking Governor Waltz.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's just some of the tea. There was some other local stuff. But it was pretty interesting. She's been on this tour, and some people are not happy. They're like, moving on, Kamala Harris. Why are you spilling this tea, pointing fingers now?
Well, I mean, I assume she made a good amount of money for writing this book.
Yeah, yeah.
So that might have something to do with
it. Cash, dollar bills.
She doesn't have a job right now.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I
that part, yeah.
I view a lot of this with a ton of skepticism, not because it's coming from Kamala Harris, not because it's about Shapiro, not because it's about Biden, but just because in any losing campaign, it just becomes this... you know, this circle of finger pointing. It's just so typical. And I'm not saying that's the entirety of her book. It's probably just what got clipped and aggregated.
Mm-hmm.
But at the end of the day, like, this is always what happens in losing campaigns. And this was an especially strange losing campaign because of the circumstances.
107 days.
And I'm not saying I don't believe anything that she said. It's just the framing, of course, is all wrapped up in that. And I just, for me, I kind of let this stuff flow under the bridge.
Yeah, and there's so much stuff going on right now. It's hard to even take a breath to look back, you know.
Yeah, I can't. I can't. So let's not look back. Let's look forward now.
Looking forward.
To a local story, because you mentioned Josh Shapiro, that actually connects to our show topic today and connects to the governor. So a federal panel recently changed its guidance to say that children should not get an MMRV vaccine before age four. Yesterday, Pennsylvania Governor Josh Shapiro broke with that guidance and said private insurers operating in the Commonwealth must continue to cover all vaccines that had been recommended by the same federal panel prior to 2025, when RFK Jr. basically fired everyone in the panel and appointed his own people. So basically, Shapiro is saying, look backwards, do not look at this particular conclusion by the new federal panel. This could also, by the way, impact insurance coverage for COVID vaccines for folks under 65. So take a look at that. And it's just the latest in a string of moves by Shapiro to distinguish state rules and regulations from the evolving guidance coming out of Washington. Just last week, Pennsylvania joined a coalition of seven states in the Northeast that will share their own vaccine guidance and collaborate on other public health initiatives, such as data collection, breaking with the federal government on some level. And there's a similar effort afoot among Western states. So this is a space to watch for sure.
Absolutely. And I mean, the fact that federal guidelines are inconsistent in many cases with the science and the data and with what doctors recommend has caused a lot of confusion, and it leaves states and many municipalities no choice but to sort of step up and do something to ensure public health is actually based on evidence. And I think people realize this, and you know, it has real life consequences as what insurance companies cover. And so the governor stepped up and said, if you're here in Pennsylvania, you have to cover these COVID vaccines.
Yeah, you said the key word, confusion. Yeah. I think everyone is feeling that way, head spinning, looking at multiple sources. There's industry groups, there's doctor groups, there's states and coalitions, and there's the federal government. And they're not all speaking with one voice. Patients are caught in the middle.
Yeah, for sure. Third story, Philadelphia is set to get 14 new historical markers. Pretty cool. That's nearly a third of the 45 approved statewide by the Pennsylvania Museum and Historical Commission. This is the first crop of new markers since they took a hiatus a couple of years ago.
And these are the little blue and yellow signs you see.
That you see around Philadelphia. Love them. By the way, some of the ones on the list include a marker for the Kensington riots of 1844, where Irish Catholics went to battle against Protestants over what religion was taught in schools. I found that very interesting. Had no idea about that. Also, the Greens Ladies Golf Club, the oldest African-American women's golf club in the Delaware Valley, was formed in 1954 in West Philly. I used to play golf, so that was pretty cool. And got to mention one, and I was like, wow. One of the new markers was inspired by our very own Avi Wolfman Arendt and his headlines of yore.
This is maybe true.
Yes. And it's because Philadelphia, and Avi always finds the Philly reference, Philadelphia was ground zero for free speech. Tell the story.
So I got an email in April from the group that was submitting this as a potential historical marker, saying that they were inspired by one of my old headlines of your radio segments and threads, which I do weekly, by the way, Thursday.
So proud.
And this historical marker, which will now apparently be going into the ground pretty soon, is about a court case called Schenck versus United States, which originated here in Philadelphia. There were a group of socialists here in Philadelphia who, around the time of World War One, distributed anti-war, anti-draft literature to draft age men. And just for doing that, they were arrested and their conviction was upheld by the Supreme Court of the United States in a 9-0 decision. The opinion included the famous line about shouting fire in a crowded theater. Side note, by the way, if you think you know what the actual quote is, you're almost certainly misremembering it. But it was written by the great Oliver Wendell Holmes Jr., the great Supreme Court judge. And it was a sort of a low tide mark for free speech in America, if you think about it.
People were going to jail for speech.
For speech, for just distributing pamphlets in this case. These people went to jail, their conviction was upheld. And of course, it results in this famous line about shouting fire in a theater. Again, look up the actual quote because you're probably misremembering what he actually said there. But what's interesting about the case, too, is that very shortly after that, the same judge, Oliver Wendell Holmes Jr., had like an evolution about free speech. And he kind of went back on what he said mm-hmm. in the crowded fire theater decision. Yeah. And when he started to evolve, that is really when free speech law in this country started to evolve. And, yeah. you know, it totally changed after that. And it's amazing to think 110 years ago,
yeah.
we didn't really have free speech as we know it in this country, including here in Philadelphia.
And by the way, I actually taught this Schenck case in my journalism law class at Temple University. So you are so on point. Yeah.
And it's always still in the news today. Free speech.
As always.
What do you know?
Welcome back to Studio 2. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman Arendt. Let's start at a place where everyone seems to agree. Rates of autism have skyrocketed in this country over the last 25 years or so. Most experts believe the cause of this increase is complex and still somewhat unknown. But President Donald Trump and HHS Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. have consistently pointed toward environmental factors.
And they did so again yesterday in a major announcement where they drew a causal link between taking Tylenol during pregnancy and autism. This despite the fact that, broadly speaking, existing research does not support their conclusion. In fact, one of our experts this hour published a study directly refuting the link between Tylenol and autism. We'll also hear from a national expert about where the field of autism research goes from here.
But first, we want to explain what all of this means for pregnant women and how you can best interpret these latest developments. And for that, let's bring in Dr. Sindhu Srinivas, professor of obstetrics and gynecology at the Perelman School of Medicine at the University of Pennsylvania and president of the Society for Maternal Fetal Medicine. Dr. Srinivas, welcome.
Thanks so much for having me.
And for all of you listening at home, on the road, and elsewhere, we invite you to participate in the conversation. Our question of the day is this: what questions do you have about President Trump linking Tylenol to autism? The number to call is 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. And if you're watching on YouTube or Facebook, share the video and then leave your comments and questions in the chat.
Before we get into all of the research and what it says, I just want to hear from you, doctor, about how you're advising the hypothetical patient that walks into your office today and asks you, can I use Tylenol while pregnant?
We are just reiterating the recommendation and advising our patients and all of our providers or members that acetaminophen is an appropriate medication to treat fever and pain in pregnancy. And that the science is pretty clear that there's really no causal link between acetaminophen use during pregnancy and autism in children.
Is there any caveat to that in terms of how much you use or when in pregnancy you might take that medication?
So what we share is that really, we always share that medications in pregnancy should be used prudently and judiciously when they're needed and in consultation with your doctor. And so those are the same things that I would say that we say for the use of acetaminophen. But I think it's so important to clarify that there's really robust science that there is no causal link between acetaminophen use and pregnancy and autism rather. And, you know, just really, really happy that you are doing this show on this topic, because it's so important to continue to reiterate that message to all the public out there.
Yeah. So what do you tell a pregnant patient in your clinic who asked, do I take it or tough it out? Because, you know, part of what the president said was don't do it. Tough it out if you can, you know, and what are you advising people who may be ill and may need it and thinking this to themselves, maybe I should just wait. Maybe I should just see, you know, and not take it at all.
It's such an important question. And I think it's so important to reiterate again that failing to treat medical conditions like persistent fever, headaches, pain can really be dangerous, both to the pregnant person and to the fetus. And so really not treating those things can have really dangerous consequences to both the pregnant person and the fetus. And so toughing it out isn't necessarily something that people should be doing. But I think when people hear that, I worry a lot about all the guilt that pregnant people feel about medications they take when they're pregnant. And how this creates a lot of anxiety for them around these choices where they feel like they're having to choose between their own discomfort and maybe causing something in their unborn child. And that's a really difficult place to put them in. And I want to keep reiterating to people, and we do to our patients all the time, that this is a situation where if you have a condition like persistent fevers, like headaches, it can be really dangerous to not treat it. And we recommend that that you take acetaminophen when needed.
I imagine some people will hear this announcement from the federal government and they'll say, okay, I won't use Tylenol or acetaminophen. I'll try to use some other type of painkiller or something else that claims to be a painkiller. Among that sort of group of others, what is considered safe and what is considered potentially dangerous when we're talking about other things that could help us deal with pain?
Really, really important question also, because there's not a lot of alternatives to acetaminophen use for fevers and pain in pregnancy. We don't recommend non-steroidal anti-inflammatory medications like people know as, Motrin or Advil, ibuprofen. That's not recommended because those do cause harm for the fetus. And we also, if you wanted to go extreme, right, other pain medicines would be narcotic pain medications like oxycodone, which have some significant implications, not just in the short term, but also in the long term in terms of addiction and other things. And so there's not really any major great alternatives to acetaminophen.
Yeah. I'm just wondering, how the narrative gets influenced because, when you hear this type of presidential announcement, you do get concerned. And I just wonder how it changes the narrative and what clinicians like yourself can do to sort of make sure that people have the type of guidance and information that is based on real science and research.
I can understand why, knowing what you shared about the facts, we know that the rates of autism have gone up, and I think people want to figure out why that is. At the same time, I think it's so important to really reiterate to all the pregnant people out there that taking appropriate medications in pregnancy is necessary, and often not treating the thing that you're taking the medication for is actually way more harmful. And really encouraging people to have a conversation with their doctors about the science, and the sort of balanced pros and cons of what you're taking it for and what some of the harms might be if you don't take it. And really encouraging people, rather than to just not take it at all, to have that conversation, open up those questions, have a dialogue with your doctor, hear the information, because a lot of times, I mean, this is a conversation we have. It's unfortunate that we're having it about acetaminophen, which is a common pain medication. Really, as we said, there's not really a lot of alternatives, or not really many alternatives at all. But this is a conversation about pros and cons, risks and benefits of medications taken in pregnancy for lots of other things. And it's a really, really important conversation to understand both sides of when you're pregnant, and encourage people to talk to their doctors about that.
One thing I wonder too is how this will influence the mentality of folks who are pregnant, because I think there is maybe a tendency for us as a society to tell folks who are pregnant, you should suffer however much you need to suffer in order to ensure the maximum, possibility of health for your child. And that so if I have a fever or I'm feeling uncomfortable, I shouldn't take Tylenol because maybe there's even the slightest undiscovered risk of a link, and I should sort of take the burden on myself. And I just wonder if this whole conversation pushes more people toward that mentality. And then if it does, what the consequences of that could be, doctor.
You asked like one of my favorite questions to talk about, because in the end, a healthy mom is needed for a healthy baby, right? And so this guilt around taking medication comes up all the time. It comes up around even things like, medications for high blood pressure, medications for mental health disorders, antidepressants. And so we really have a conversation about the untreated condition is really often worse. And if medications can help treat a condition and make a mom healthier while they're pregnant, that is actually the best thing for the pregnancy and for the baby. And so I do worry about this feeding into that kind of narrative that is already out there around people feeling really guilty and feeling like they should tough it out, really not recognizing that toughing it out actually might not even be the best thing for the pregnancy and the baby, and often is not. And so I think it's a such an important question, and really important for us to be having these conversations so we start to help people feel comfortable about the fact that it's okay to take medications that you need to take to treat things while you're pregnant. And in fact, that's probably better for you and better for the pregnancy.
Real quick, just before we get you out of here, because it kind of leads us into our next conversation. I think what sort of creates some of the confusion in this space is that I would imagine it's very difficult to do controlled experiments around medication and people who are pregnant because there's going to be ethical concerns. And so you end up relying on like large scale population level studies. And then you end up in this place. Like, I remember going through this a bit when my wife was pregnant, where like all the recommendations feel like a little soft and squishy, like we don't know for sure. How do you help people as a doctor like navigate that confusion, which stems from, I think, some very legitimate research concerns, which maybe prevent us from getting the hardest conclusions on all this type of stuff?
Well, at the heart of your question is just an advocating for the inclusion of pregnant people in trials in general, right? We have some of that lack of information and knowledge because we don't include pregnant people in studies that are important and are necessary to answer some of these questions. So I'll say that first at the very heart is that we need to be continuing to advocate for the inclusion of pregnant people in trials. Secondly, I think we have to really be very critical of the evidence that's out there and the methodologies of the studies. I think you mentioned that you have an author of one of the more recent studies, and it's a super well done, very rigorous study that's showing that there's no causal link between acetaminophen and neurobehavioral disorders. Some of the other studies, when you're doing them retrospectively, which means like from the past, you're asking for people to recall things about what they did. They don't remember exactly how much they took or when they took it. And there is a bias around people who have children that might be affected in some way that they're more likely to recall certain things. So it might really falsely or erroneously give us some conclusions that are not true. And so it's so important for the methodologic rigor of a study to be evaluated when you're looking at the conclusions. And those are some of the conversations we have with patients too about the types of studies that lead us to some of what we're recommending.
I learned a ton here. I just want to thank you so much for your insights, Dr. Srinivas. That was Dr. Sindhu Srinivas, Professor of Obstetrics and Gynecology at the Perelman School of Medicine at the University of Pennsylvania and President of the Society for Maternal Fetal Medicine. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thanks so much for having me.
And now let's bring in two more experts to help us understand where researchers are in their quest to find the causes of autism and potential treatments. First, we have Brian Lee in studio with us. Brian is professor of epidemiology at Drexel University's Dorns Life School of Public Health. Brian, welcome to Studio Two.
Thank you for having me.
And we also have Catherine Lord, clinical psychologist and professor of, oh, Catherine will be here in just a moment. Oh, there she is.
Here
Catherine
I am.
Lord is clinical psychologist and professor of psychiatry at UCLA. Catherine, welcome.
Hi.
Yes. And we want to start with you, Brian, because Dr. Srinivas sort of teased up your study, which directly refutes some of what President Donald Trump said yesterday about the link between Tylenol and autism. Could you tell us what you found in your research?
Sure. So my team and I did a study of 2.5 million pregnancies in Sweden, moms and their children followed for around 20 years or so. And this is a two-part story because what we found initially when we're looking at the moms who used acetaminophen and looked at their kids and compared against the moms who didn't use acetaminophen and looked at their kids, what we found was a statistical association of, that acetaminophen supposedly causes autism or ADHD. But as we all should know by now, association is not causation. And this is the kind of thing I'd like to tell my students. So, for example, eating ice cream is statistically associated with risk of drowning.
They both happen in the
Wow.
summer.
Yeah.
Exactly, right? There's that third factor factor out there that's external, but it's explaining that association. In the same way, when we're looking at the moms who use acetaminophen versus the moms who don't, this is kind of an apples to orange comparison, because who uses acetaminophen? If you have a health condition that requires it, right? You are going to be sicker in some sort of way. You're going to just be different. It's an apples to oranges comparison. And interestingly, a lot of the reasons one might take acetaminophen, having an infection during pregnancy, having a fever, even things like headache and migraines, these are actually associated with risk of neurodevelopmental disorders.
Right.
So what we wanted to do for the second part of our story was to do an apples to apples comparison and get at one of the biggest elephants in the room that we don't normally talk about with autism, and that's genetics. So when you do these studies of acetaminophen, you're just trying to isolate out everything else and just looking at that one thing. But if you don't have data on genetics, you can't really get at that. Our team got around this issue by looking at siblings. So looking specifically at mothers and parents, I should say, where their kids, one of them was exposed to acetaminophen in the womb during pregnancy, and the other one wasn't. Exactly. So when we're doing the sibling comparison, the parents are completely the same, so therefore the genetics is removed out. There's no possible way this could confound. When we did the sibling analysis, the association disappeared.
Wow.
And that to us indicated.
And when you say the association disappeared, it meant what?
There's no more statistical association. In other words, there doesn't appear to be any reason to believe that acetaminophen causes autism or ADHD.
So looking within sibling pairs, if one child was born when the mom was taking Tylenol and the other was born the mom was not taking Tylenol, those two siblings were just as likely to have autism.
Exactly.
Wow.
And so that tries to isolate away the idea that what could be driving this association is these other factors that are really, really hard to account for in these big population level surveys. Is that right?
Exactly. Because normally when we do these population level studies, you don't have data on certain things.
Throws like, down on everything. Exactly.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. Did you have this health condition? Were you having lots of fevers, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera? You just have big, broad, demographic categories maybe, but you don't have the drill down you need.
Right, exactly. And so a lot of the existing studies on this topic that seem to be the basis for this administration's push on acetaminophen rely solely on these data that do not take into account genetics or other confounders that could potentially explain the association. But our study, as well as some other ones that have taken this more rigorous approach to control for confounding, find no good reason to believe that this causal effect exists.
By the way, I want to invite our folks who are listening at home, on the road, and elsewhere to participate in the conversation. The question is, what questions do you have about President Trump linking Tylenol to autism? The number is 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. And if you're watching on YouTube or Facebook, drop those comments in the chat. We have Hadar from University City on the line. We want to bring them in. Hadar, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
Well, maybe a question and comment. Long story short, I have three kids. One of them actually is considered autistic. And my wife did take Tylenol, and it never affected the other children. But the point of it is, I'm just from a scientific standpoint, just from a law standpoint, for the President of the United States to sit here and, put these laws, on parents, where, I'm a Republican myself, and to say that we're a party of freedom of speech and rights to do what we want as we please, as long as it's under the constitutional law, and to do this, it's just the hypocrisy is so out there. I don't know what to make of it, really.
Thank you, Hadar.
Hadar from University City.
So let me bring Catherine Lord from UCLA into the conversation now. And so one of the things we haven't addressed yet is if Tylenol is not indeed sort of causing this increase in autism, what is? And one thing that I know you work on, Catherine, is diagnostics when it comes to neurodivergence. So I'm curious just about your work and how the sort of the definitions, the diagnostics around autism have shifted over the decades, and how that might explain what we're seeing right now.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's very clear that our definitions of autism have gotten broader and broader to include milder and milder forms of this difficulty. And people are so much more aware of autism now, so they're more likely to go to a doctor and say, could my child have autism? Or even as an adult, ask for an assessment. So those are two factors that have had huge effects, which we've been able to document. It's also easier to say for a child who has multiple problems, let's just say they have autism, and with autism often comes services. And so I think there's pressure to say more and more people have it because you can get more services, which isn't fair, but is needed. And so all those factors contribute to these growing numbers. And we know that autism is not one thing. Yeah. It's not caused by one thing. And so I think that looking for a simple answer is just put such a burden on parents and pregnant women, and is so unfair.
Yeah. And you know, Catherine, what do we know about what causes autism? Because you said it's no one thing and it's complex. And so I want you to kind of explain some of the nuance and complexity that go into a diagnosis.
Well, I think as Dr. Lee said, we know a lot about associations and less about causes. I think the causes that we know about are in a certain proportion, and this is probably maybe a quarter or a third of autistic kids, we can find a genetic pattern that doesn't occur in people who don't have autism or quite marked other intellectual disabilities. So that's one factor. I think another factor also related to genetics is that if you have one child with autism, your chances of having another child with autism go up dramatically. They're not the majority, but they go up from one in whatever it is, 36 or 31, to one in five or one in 10. Mm. And that seems to be actually another kind of genetics, perhaps, than those specific genetic patterns that have been identified with kids who have severe intellectual disability and often epilepsy. So there's two kinds of genetics that are contributing. And then I think we do believe that there probably are, in addition, environmental effects, which may be small or might interact with the genetics. And actually, Dr. Lee could probably tell you more about that than I can, but there's some kind of interaction. Yeah. And I think what it comes down to, unfortunately, I mean, it's always true, is when you have a child, it's an act of faith. You know, none of us know what we're going to get. And you are saying, I invest in the future and this little person. And right now we can't, you know, there are very few things where we can tick off, okay, it's not this, it's not this, it's not this, which is really hard. And yeah. I think blaming anybody, even indirectly by talking about Tylenol during pregnancy is really tough.
And obviously you can empathize with parents, the frustration they might feel when they go to a clinician and the clinician says, well, we don't know for sure. And science is still trying to investigate this. We're going to talk about that investigation on the other side of this break, because a lot of fingers are being pointed in the direction of environmental factors. And I want to talk about whether or not that's the direction we should be pointing fingers, or whether the bulk of the research should look a different direction. So let's tee up that conversation for the other side of this break. We have some callers on the line, some commenters we want to bring in as well. The number is 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. What questions do you have about President Trump linking Tylenol to autism? Let us know. This is Studio 2.
Welcome back to Studio 2 here at WHYY. I am Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Aaron. We're talking today about President Trump's announcement yesterday linking Tylenol use during pregnancy with a higher risk of autism. The administration is advising pregnant women to avoid taking acetaminophen, the active ingredient in Tylenol. But many scientists and doctors are pushing back. They say Tylenol is the safest painkiller for expecting moms and that the autism link is unsubstantiated. We've been discussing all of that with our guest this hour. Brian Lee is professor of epidemiology at Drexel University's Dornsife School of Public Health. And Catherine Lord is clinical psychologist and professor of psychiatry at UCLA.
Yes, and we want to hear from you. What questions do you have about President Trump linking Tylenol to autism? The number is 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. And if you're watching on YouTube or Facebook, drop those comments in the chat. I'm going to read a few comments we've gotten. Rosina on Facebook says, I think Trump jumped on that too soon. I took Tylenol with 6 pregnancies and no autism in that. Keisha says, this is a dangerous road to go down. First Tylenol, then birth control, then epidurals. Thrilled I am past the childbearing age. Incensed for any mother blaming herself for taking Tylenol and for the continued intrusion of men policing and controlling women's bodies. I want to bring in Dennis from Northeast Philadelphia. He's on the line. Dennis, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
Hey, how are you?
Hey, Dennis.
Good.
Cool. I'm just looking at, you know, have we mapped anything with demographics or geography that, you know, presents more concentrations in autism in those populations or in those demographics, whether it's, you know, domestic, like international or, you know, within the country. Yeah,
that's a great question. And I know, Dennis, I think I brought up to our producer, toxic air, PFAS. We have another caller who wants to talk about microplastics. And so, Brian, the bigger question here is environmental factors. So we know that some of the things that, for instance, RFK Jr. has alluded to, like vaccines as an environmental factor that causes autism, that link is disproven. Tylenol, we've been talking about this hour, there's really no great research to support that link as a causal link. However, there's other things out there. And I think one of the big questions now is how much research energy we should focus on looking at those environmental factors versus other things that could be causes here. And I'm just curious how you as a researcher think about that quandary.
Yeah, that's a great question. Basically, where should we focus our research energy? There's only so much research that can be done. You know, Dennis pointed out that there are disparities between different areas. Like, for example, New Jersey has one of the highest autism prevalences. That doesn't necessarily mean that there's an environmental factor in New Jersey that's making New Jersey kids have more autism. It could just be better diagnostics.
Or incentives for diagnostics, like Catherine Lord brought up earlier. Perhaps there are services available in New Jersey that would incentivize people to make sure they get that diagnosis.
Right. So, you know, I think more rigorous scientists would actually want to measure what's around us, what folks are exposed to during critical developmental windows. So pregnancy is an obvious developmental window that we'd want to take a look at. Things that have been credibly associated with autism, there's quite a few out there, but I'll just name a few off the top of my head. Air pollution is one of those that has been linked out with autism and a host of other health conditions. And, you know, the research there isn't necessarily, you know, trying to figure out if air pollution is good or bad for you, because I don't think anyone's going to say that it's
good for you.
Right. But I think from a more sort of scientific standpoint, we want to understand what sort of mechanisms are going on, and air pollution has, you know, some potential there. So I think, you know, nailing down whether that is really a cause or not, again, this is association is not causation. We need to improve on the science. But that is one of the credible risk factors. And another risk factor, when I say risk factor, I'm not using this in a pejorative sense. Yeah. This is there's no blame, but another factor that has been credibly attached to autism is older parents. Yep. So having a child at an older age has been consistently shown in over 40 studies to be associated. But this is a complicated thing, because it's not necessarily that older parents, older parents have older sperm, older eggs, you know, that sort of thing, that where there's opportunity for things to not necessarily be optimal.
Yeah.
So that's one aspect. But another aspect could be simply that persons with different genetic backgrounds are having children at an older age.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And you might imagine
so many confounding variables here. I mean, it just sounds impossible on some level.
And I wonder, and if I was trying to look for a silver lining in this announcement, right? And one of the things that the Trump administration announced is millions of dollars going into autism research. And so, Brian, if you were to say, you know what, this is what we should focus on, if you were in charge, you know, and had access to that money, what would you say? Like, this is one thing that is not being looked at that I think we should.
Yeah, well, a silver lining in the cloud here, yesterday's announcement about the Autism Data Science Initiatives, which is a $50 million initiative to fund research into what causes autism, I think that was actually well done. When I looked at the funded grants, and we got a couple at Drexel University, my good colleague Dr. Kristen Lyle, who is also an autism epidemiologist, is looking at diet during pregnancy and whether there are things there that could tweak autism risk. And I think that's an example of an amazing research that could be done. But I was very glad to see that the administration did not put their thumb on the scale and fund 10 different studies looking to see whether vaccines cause autism. Mm.
Yeah. A quick follow-up, because leucovorin was mentioned as a possible treatment for autism. Could you talk about that and what the research says? Does it provide hope for families?
Yeah, for leucovorin, there's a seed of plausibility, is what I'll say. Leucovorin is a form of folic acid. And in general, folic acid we know to be extremely important for neurodevelopment. You take folic acid supplements before or during pregnancy to reduce risk of neural tube defects. And if you have a folate deficiency, that actually increases risk of neural tube defects, right? So no one, I think, is doubting whether or not these things could have neurological properties. The question, however, though, is alleviating autism symptoms, it's incredibly underdeveloped in terms of the evidence base. There's only been a handful of small clinical trials. And when I say small, I'm talking like 20 people.
Yeah.
It's just not anything to make a therapeutic recommendation on. It's not ready for prime time.
I'm curious if you have thoughts on that, Catherine Lord, about this recommendation around leucovorin, link between folate and autism, and sort of how soon is too soon when it comes to the federal government promoting some of these potential treatments? Like, what would you ideally like to see before the federal government makes an announcement of this type?
I mean, I think this would be a perfect time to fund really careful randomized controlled trials of leucovorin, because there is some logic to why it might help. And there's been a lot of enthusiasm I've seen in parents who find out about it, but the level of research is very limited. And so this is a chance to do it. And we've got to look carefully, because we know that there are just huge effects of hope and enthusiasm when people try something new. And if we don't have good measures of what we really think is changing and ways to control that hope in some ways, we're going to end up with people spending a lot of time and wasted money. Mm. So now's our chance. Yeah. So let's do it. Let's push HHS to fund some randomized controlled trials of leucovorin and maybe other medications if they want. Yeah. Because people are going to try this. I think it's almost impossible for families not to try it.
Yeah.
Yeah. I want to read this comment from Dandelion on YouTube, who says, "If it helps to know, I never used Tylenol. I never drank alcohol or coffee. I was super careful about everything, enough to drive those around me nuts. And my now adult has autism." So person did everything right, and still autism was there. CR, is calling us from the Turnpike. CR, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
Well, I have a bunch of comments for this. I'm on the spectrum. When I was born, I don't think Tylenol was even out for a year, so I don't know what kind of marketing they had back then, or if my mother even took it or did anything with it. I still ended up on the spectrum. I grew up in a time when you maybe got four vaccinations when you were a kid. You got polio, smallpox, tetanus, and maybe one more. Not like he claims that there's 80 vaccines you get now as a child.
Talking about the president there, yes.
How many diseases are there out there that are you would have 80 vaccines? And I hate needles, so, you know, they would want to get the vaccination in me in one shot. Because
yeah.
I wouldn't want to go back to you. And
I'm curious, CR, real quick, how does, like, yesterday's news make you
yeah.
feel? Like, what was your emotional reaction to
hearing this? Oh, everyone wants to cure this and cure that. He wants to marginalize another subset of the population of the United States. Oh, let's demonize autistic people now. Well, mm-hmm. It's so horrible. You know, when I was in school, I was listed learning disabled, and the diagnosis was socially and emotionally disturbed because they didn't have another name mm-hmm. for it, and that's exactly what's going on.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thank you, CR.
That's CR.
And drive safe, by the way, CR.
From the Turnpike. And
drive safe.
And Catherine, I think CR says such good things. I mean, you know, from a perspective of someone who's on the spectrum, and I think about the impact that it's having for folks, you know, who hear this, you know, the impact on mothers who hear this and may have taken Tylenol and yeah. are dealing with they're with their autistic child or a child on the spectrum. And sort of like, how do we sort of deal with that reality, but also try to sort of correct the messaging and make sure that people understand some of the complexities that go into a diagnosis of autism? Because I think there's a lot of confusion now. There could possibly be finger pointing. How do you deal with all of that, Catherine?
I mean, I think part of it is autism is just one part of anybody, like a child, you know, your child, and it can radically change a child's life, but it doesn't always. And people love their children. I mean, one of the most amazing things working with families who have children with autism is how much they rise to the occasion and work around their child. And the kids are all different and they have strengths and weaknesses just like the rest of us. So I think that this does, I mean, where I would say we've been particularly lacking is in research about what do you do differently for different people with autism. And we don't know much about that. And ideally, we would sort that out more efficiently. But I think that this does end up feeling like we're blaming both the mother and the autistic person. And yeah. we also have so much more hope for what happens with autistic kids as they grow up now.
Yeah.
So much more recognition of things we can do to support them and how much they can do. So I hope that people don't get too lost in the negativity here of, you know, this is, we know what it's caused and we're going to cure it, as opposed to let's look at what we've got and all the things people can do.
Real quick, we're about to wrap up. Alex from Montgomeryville is on line one. Alex, in maybe 30 seconds or less, I would love to hear your comment today on Studio 2.
I'll try to be super quick. First, the last person who just spoke, 100%. I'm tired of people thinking that autism is a limitation. I myself am on the spectrum. I have two kids who are. I don't see it as a limitation. I think they have to adapt, but I think it's a gift. The thing that I wanted to bring up is I do not think this is based on medication or vaccination. I think the one consistent thing that has changed in the United States, unlike any other country, in the past 20 years is our food. Mm-hmm. The food that we are eating, the level of its processing, the additives and ingredients, I think there could be a link there. But again, I'm tired of hearing it as a negative thing.
Yeah, thank you, Alex. And let me ask you, Brian, as we wrap up, is that an area researchers are looking at? Diet, you mentioned actually diet earlier for pregnant women, but diet more generally, I don't know, that is an area of study?
Yeah, definitely an area of study. Nutrition during pregnancy is incredibly important. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, the Autism Data Science Initiative that's funding Dr. Kristen Lyle's research in the next 2 years, we're hoping to look at exactly some of these issues. Processed foods, for example, you know, and this is something that RFK Jr. has brought up a number of times.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
And it's somewhere where there is lockstep with some folks in the administration who are also concerned about the impact of processed foods, not just when it comes to autism, but all sorts of health outcomes. So, you know, that doesn't mean there's not total disagreement here, right, Brian?
Exactly. We can find some common ground here.
Yep. Yeah. Well, I think the one good thing is that there's attention on this and money going into this. Even if the science doesn't line up with what the administration is saying, people are talking about this and having this conversation.
Yeah, and let me thank you both for having this conversation with us today. Brian Lee, professor of epidemiology at Drexel University's Dornsife School of Public Health. Brian, thanks so much for coming in today.
Thanks for having me.
And with the last of my voice, Catherine Lord, let me thank you, clinical psychologist and professor of psychiatry at UCLA. Thanks for zooming in today, Catherine.
Thank you.
And Amy leaves this comment. Mm-hmm. I'll finish with this. Isn't stress overall the most damaging thing to a pregnancy? Life is becoming more and more stressful, and this proclamation is only going to make women more stressed at a time when they need to be peaceful and positive in body and mind. So that's Amy's thought to wrap up the show today.
Yeah, and sorry we couldn't get to you, Ross from South Philly.
Yeah,
maybe
Ross.
Next time, call in, we'll get you on the air. By the way, thank you so much to our producers who put everything together.
Yeah, big thank you today.
Yes, Debbie Builder and Andreas Copes worked hard on this show. Thanks to Mike Schiffler, our visual producer, and to Al Banks and Tina Calique, who engineered today's show. Our executive producer is Kevin McCory. From Studio 2 here at WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Cherry Gregg.
And we thank them every day. But there's levels of thank you.
And this is a big level. This is a high level.
A big thank
you.
I'm Avi Wolf. Thanks for joining us. We'll talk to you tomorrow.